I grew up in Utah and there weren't a lot of income producing women who were outside of the home that decided to work and have children or have other responsibilities. I wanted to be an example for these young women to showcase that you can be a mom and that you can also have a career, and that I get to personify this mission statement, which is to promote, advance, and advocate for women in financial services.
This is Bridging the Gap with your host, Matt Reiner.
Lindsay Lewis, welcome to Bridging the Gap. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, aside from a little bit of a cold, but we're hanging in there.
You know, it's that time of year, right? You got allergies, you got the weather going from 80 degrees to 35 degrees, at least here locally right now at this time of year. So, I mean, it's perfect for the immune system right now.
It is exactly what you would expect for this time of
year. Yes. And I believe you have some young kids or kids, so that's always, they're always bringing germs home all the time anyways, which
yeah, they're just like walking petri dishes. So yeah, you just never know with children going to school and daycare.
It's unbelievable. I mean, remember like they would shut down daycare, I remember back when COVID was happening, because you know, one great grandparent of a kid had COVID and they saw them 14 months ago, but now they can go with sniffles and coughs and everything and they don't send them home. So it's, yeah, you know, it's trying to figure that all out. But, you know, we're all learning in that period of time. So it's okay.
Hey, I'll take it. You know, like this is just the cold we all have rather than, you know, shutting down completely. So
I am on that train. Well, this is going to be an awesome conversation. I am really stoked about this. I think that your perspective as the executive director of the American College for Women in Financial Services, you have perspective in. And you've been in the industry. You worked at LVS. You've been part of the industry. You've been a planner. And I think that the perspective that you have to help with, how are we better at talent acquisition, talent retention? How are we better at diversity with our talent? And then training our talent and all that stuff. I think that this is such a problem or a challenge that I've experienced inside of our industry and our company, and also within the conversations I have within the industry. So I'm stoked to dive into it with you and get your perspective on it. Before we do, though, you know, I've got to ask. You've had an amazing track record to get to where you are, but what did the 13-year-old Lindsay Lewis want to be when she grew up?
Yeah, you would have found the 13-year-old Lindsay Lewis in a gymnastics gym. So I grew up, I have six brothers, no sisters, very sports oriented. And so I always thought I would be in the sports related field, whether that's medical or within athletics marketing or something like that. I'm still super passionate about sports. At the time we're recording this, it's right before March Madness. And so last night, I'm madly filling out my bracket against all my brothers. And so I had this deep passion for athletics. I still do, which I think paired really nicely coming into financial services. Growing up with a lot of brothers, I, you know, was in rooms where I was the only woman many times. And so coming into financial services, I'm like, oh, yep, feel comfortable here. So I definitely thought my 13-year-old self would be somewhere in sports in some sort of regard. I feel like financial services is just as competitive as sports, maybe even more competitive in some ways. And so though it's not like a natural change, but it was something that I was really passionate about.
That is really interesting. And I want to put a pin in it and come back to it, because the idea of you growing up with six brothers, which God bless you, and you've made it. Congratulations.
I mean, that's incredible. Survived.
That's unbelievable. I mean, that deserves like an anointment of, you know, whatever it can be. I mean, that's like, but that is interesting that you grew up in that environment and then what you were trying to do in the financial services world, given that it's been such a man-dominated or male-dominated culture, it seems like the perfect fit for someone to be able to go and make that change because of your background. But before we get into that, tell us how you got to this point, right? From the 13-year-old gym rat that was in gymnastics, sports junkie, to now being in financial services. Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, that journey was such an evolution, but I ended up competing in sports in college. So I was a track athlete. I went into my undergrad thinking I wanted to become an accountant after I decided I didn't want to do athletics, because I knew that there would always be a job there. And my mom's an accountant, and I'm, you know, the last person who's getting laid off at a job is an accountant. So I'm like, this is going to be a safe job. But I met with someone and they in the academics department, and they're like, you have way too much of a personality to be an accountant. We just launched this financial planning program. I think you would be a great fit. And so I actually completed the CFP registered program as my undergrad, which is incredible because you are, you know, you just have this springboard into success into the industry because you can actually sit for the certified financial planner exam your senior year of college. And so I was a CFP and then I went back and got my MBA all before age 25. And so it just kind of catapulted me into the career. So I made that pivot and then I started off in the RIA space. So I worked at a wealth management firm helping institutional clients with their retirement plans, primarily 401ks, 403bs. Also did a little bit of work with high net worth folks. And then after working there, I pivoted to working at a large broker dealer where I worked in the senior financial advisor capacity. I really wanted to prove to myself that I could handle individual clients and that I could help make them successful. And based on the metrics within that firm, I was very successful. I built a book from $0 to $200 million in 12 months, was so tired. And I did this during COVID. And then I think COVID was a catalyst for a lot of people making adjustments in their lives. I was reflecting as I had one of my children at that time and, you know, talking about the family planning conversation and having more children, you know, being super stressed and knowing that my passion really was with women and next gen folks and underrepresented groups and making sure that they had access to financial services, but also that they could pursue this industry as a career opportunity. So I have hosted an event at my alma mater for the last 5 years. We're going into our sixth year for young women who are interested in entrepreneurship, leadership, and finance. And I did that because I grew up in Utah and there weren't a lot of income producing women who were outside of the home that decided to work and have children or have other responsibilities. And I wanted to be an example for these young women to showcase that you can be a mom and that you can also have a career as an income producing woman. And so that is what brought me to the college. So that's why I'm an advisor gone academic and that I get to personify this mission statement, which is to promote, advance, and advocate for women in financial services. And we do that through thought leadership, education, community, and research. And it's been really cool to have that as, you know, a mission-driven work that I'm paid for. So there's a proverb that's called Ikigai, which is like what you love, what you get paid for, what brings purpose, and what is like going to benefit the world. And it's cool that my job is really a lot of that intersection of those different areas. That's kind of what brought me here. A lot of the times, even my spouse, he's like, I don't know exactly what you do. It's like, I think you work somewhere, but I'm like, no, I work at an online college that trains financial professionals and I work in a center of excellence. And you can think of our centers like different schools that would be at a traditional university. So, you know, you have your business school or humanities or whatever. So I work and specialize with women, but the college has areas where we specialize with advisors that help folks with special needs, or we have ones for the Center of Economic Empowerment and Equality, which is for underrepresented groups, for military, for, you know, financial security, financial income, wellness, ethics. And so that's really what pivoted and brought me to where I'm at. The course is not linear in the sense of what it's like for traditional financial advisors, but I really like to help them along the path. And I also do work with our Next Gen Advisory Task Force. And that group is dedicated to illustrating diverse folks who are in financial services and diverse roles that they have. I think frequently you see only the client-facing advisor as like, this is the solution. However, as financial services adopts and grows bigger and the integration of AI, you'll see folks that like myself, who are certified financial planner professionals that could work in a variety of different capacities, whether that's marketing or integrating technology. And so getting more exposure to diverse folks, whether that's women, underrepresented groups, to any type of job opportunity within financial services will start building the pool that's larger so more people have awareness around what people do within this industry.
The idea of the pool getting bigger is something I want to come back to as well, because that gets into the diversity and how do we expand that pool. But I want to kind of start the conversation by going to the root of talent management and then build up to diversity on that side of it, because I'm curious. Finding talent has been harder and harder and harder. I know you probably hear it all the time, but to find good quality talent, any section, any division, but you kind of label it to the advisor, it's been difficult. And I'm curious from your perspective, what is the friction? Like, what is the root of it? Is it a lack of preparation on the collegiate level? Is it a lack of investment by the industry of firms, or is it also closed-mindedness of firms? Like, where is the friction happening when it comes to the challenge? Because when there's a challenge, there's a friction. There's two things rubbing against each other. And I'm trying to identify what that is, what that root is from your perspective when it comes to talent, finding great talent.
Well, definitely D, all of the above. I think it's a combination of a variety of different things. But if you actually look at the rising generation, whether that be Gen Z or Gen Alpha, you see that they have a lot of exposure to investing at different levels than they have in the past, where, you know, 25% of Gen Z, their first investment is into a crypto asset. So they're definitely curious. But also you have combined with that only 35 of the 50 states require some level of financial literacy in order to graduate high school. And some of that is in some schools and in some states, that's just one class and one time, right? In my adult life, I have not used the Pythagorean theorem once to help me solve a problem. However, because I had a financial literacy class in my high school that talked about, you know, auto insurance and a variety of different things, like I learned how to file my taxes in college. And so that is applicable and I can use that in my life. So you have, you know, a financial illiteracy or unwellness or, you know, no foundation that is there. And then you have kind of this cryptic understanding of what it's like to be a financial advisor. And when you look at folks' trust in financial professionals, so you go on the list, you know, it's like used car salesman, financial professional, right? People don't trust financial professionals, let alone understand what they do in the day-to-day. What's interesting is that through the research at the American College, we did one on the traits of successful financial advisors and financial professionals. And we found out that 60% of them get into this industry because they want to help and serve people. But how many job descriptions do you see in financial services that are talking about helping people with their, you know, financial wellness and understanding their goals and expectations? Because as a financial professional and an advisor, when I'm sitting across the table with an individual client, majority of the time is understanding their goals, their expectations, and so that I can align the profile, the recommendations to their specific needs. But there's this disconnect of you can be really technically savvy in financial planning software, and you can learn how to do discounted cash flows or whatever. And that's not correlating with these individuals. Also, what we see in young folks is that they want a sense of purpose with their job. They want to get paid for what they do. And they want to, you know, they have a values alignment with the institution that they're working for. So if they don't feel values alignment within this institution, then one, they're not going to apply. And two, perhaps the value of the institution isn't something that they value. And when you see, you know, through like FinTalk and things like that, where they might have a different view of capitalism and what they think of the stock market, or if you're looking at different subsections of underrepresented groups, like their belief system in money and the growth of money is actually very different than perhaps like a white affluent family. And so it's also understanding kind of those cultural and gender and different narratives that are behind it. Additionally, you have these firms that are trying to attract this talent. And I'm working on a course that's talking about the landscape of financial services, because starting at a wirehouse is very different than starting at an RIA, which is different than starting at a broker dealer, which is different than starting at fintech. And the two things that I typically like to point out as I help consult young folks, one is what I call income risk tolerance, and two is income risk capacity. So income risk tolerance is how comfortable am I if my paychecks vary? And so if I, you know, don't feel comfortable with differing paychecks or getting paid at different intervals, then perhaps, you know, starting off on the DIY or an independent broker dealer status like would not work for me. Or income risk capacity. So how much risk can I have if I miss a paycheck? So for myself, as a parent of two young children who prioritizes health insurance, I don't have as much income risk capacity as I do as my younger brother who lives at home. And so what I find within these institutions is that you have a misalignment of perhaps those two values of income risk capacity and income risk tolerance with models and structures that weren't built for them. I mean, when you have institutions that still require folks to knock doors and safety is a priority for a woman in an environment, like not necessarily what they're going to sign up for. Also, when you look at the incentive packages and perhaps, you know, time autonomy is more important than getting a fat bonus. And so just looking at making sure models align, I think the other component is that there's not a clear path at some institutions of like, this is how you become a financial advisor, and this is how you become a senior advisor, and this is how you make it. And also some people might only want to just do a job. And so it's really understanding and adapting the business model. But when you see that, you know, an assets under management or an AUM model has been highly successful and you haven't really made any adjustments, and majority of your clients might have certain values or experiences, and then you, let's say you bring in a queer Latin woman and they don't know how to react and she doesn't know how to react, and you have microaggressions or, you know, comments that are made that perhaps aren't intentionally like to hurt that person, but they're happening over and over again. And then that's like making them want to drop out. Also, I mean, the stats are here where like 72% of rookie advisors have failed or left the industry, but we have such a big problem because over 40% of the financial advisor workforce plans to retire in the next decade. So we have fewer people coming in, lots of people failing out, and then lots of folks wanting to leave. So if we don't start making real concerted efforts in order for this talent pipeline, we're going to run into a big problem in the next, you know, 4 to 5 years when it comes to managing these assets. And I mean, this industry is so prime for anyone to join because you have, you know, $90 to $100 trillion of assets that are transitioning. By the year 2030, it's anticipated that women will control $30 trillion worth of assets. America as a whole is moving to a minority majority by 2050. So the business case and argument for diverse representation and talent has never been bigger than it has been at this specific moment.
You know, there's so much in there that I thought was so great. And I'll touch on that last point. I'd be curious on your side. It, you know, as you were talking about it, I just got like a flashback to like client conversations with that, right? Because like the trends are there, like the data is there that we need to make changes. But like, for instance, that we're going to be a minority majority, you know, country in by 2050, that idea, like there's data backing it. There's trends that show that. But it's also like when I tell a client, hey, you're 30 years old, in 30 years, you're going to need this much money. They still don't do what I ask them or what I position, despite having all the facts and all the information, because it is so far in the future, it's hard to comprehend. And I wonder if our industry, not to rationalize for them, if that's one of the challenges, is because it's so hard to comprehend something so drastically different that it makes me just overwhelmed, that I just revert to being like, I can't handle it right now. Maybe that's it. But I also think something that you said earlier, which is super interesting, is, you know, this idea of route to success. Like people failing out of the industry, that needs to change, because there's opportunities at some amazing RIA firms. Like too many people think that you got to go to Morgan or Merrill or the big broker dealers where they make you call dial for dollars. And like, no wonder you're out. Like that's the industry has evolved. So it's like, we've got to be better at communicating that change. And then, you know, I wonder, two other points that you said, I'd love your feedback on it. I wonder if there's this challenge to what you're saying, is that I wonder if people feel that the industry is so technical that they have to be so knowledgeable on like They have to be numbers people and analytical people. But in reality, this is a relational industry. And so if you're a human person that wants to make a purpose to the final point, like, what better industry or job to make an impact on someone's life? If you're able to help them retire and live their purpose longer, there is no more from, you know, to the source that you can have that control than being the advisor, where you're talking to the actual person and helping them get there. And so there's so much opportunity to educate both the industry, right, to that point about the cultural dynamics and how we're falling into the same trap that our clients are falling into, and that we need to start adopting some changes. But then also to the pool of opportunity of new talent, like, this is what it means. And we've got to be more open about what it means, because it seems like it's a closed door. I don't know if this is going to come back and bite me, but it's like a closed door bro club. And like, that's wrong. It shouldn't be that, because that's not what it is. It's not what it is anymore.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Carson Group, they have a great study about women in wealth management. I invite you all to look it up and read it. But it really is the perception of, like, you had this like country club good old boys, and now it's like this corporate bro, like Patagonia vest vibe. And so it's like understanding and making a difference there. But when you look at financial advisors and financial professionals, they aren't always like initially thinking about, you know, their firm as business owners. Like, they're looking at like, I need to get this many assets under management and I need to like reduce my expenses, and they understand that. But majority of them don't have a formal succession plan in mind as a financial professional. And so they're going to exit this business, but they don't have the foresight of what the sale is going to look like in the future. And so if they're not cultivating those relationships way in advance, if you have any clients who are business owners, you know that the sale process can take a decade on the front end or the back end of whenever they want to retire. And so there are thousands of companies, millions of companies for sale, whether that's advisory firms or just companies, small companies in general, that can't find buyers because they haven't built those relationships. And same with talent, right? They just envision like, oh, I'm going to retire in 3 years. I'm sure I can find someone. But sometimes fostering that engagement with a next-gen advisor takes much longer than that. And you also look at what folks are wanting and how to make people successful. It's both having mentors in and out of your organization. What we found with women and men, and, you know, we're not including non-binary folks in this discussion, but with men and women, they don't necessarily have a preference towards having a male mentor or a female mentor. But what we find with women, if they're looking for a woman mentor within their organization, if they have a small organization and they're at a smaller firm, there might not be a woman in leadership that can be their mentor. And so that dynamic of, they might find a female mentor, but it's going to be outside of their organization, versus if they had someone within their organization, then that person's advocating for them when they're not there, right? And they're saying, oh, you know, this person had such a great idea and is really helping their clients and just signed, you know, a $100 million account or whatever. But if they don't have that advocacy internally, then sometimes that makes it a little bit more challenging. And so for any of our listeners out there that might be, you know, men, you can be a great male ally by just supporting and helping those next gen folks and women by just voicing for them when they're not there, or, you know, looking at them for projects, or not, or, you know, not making an assumption that they wouldn't be interested in something because, like, I have two kids and I go to soccer practice, right? Like, I can change my priorities based on like what I envision for the future. So I think there's little ways that you can make cultural shifts. And then to your point around kind of changing the narrative of financial services at large, I think in the past you've seen kind of a values misalignment of, you know, like, people are motivated by specific money outcomes. And with the evolution of different type of planning models and retainer models and, you know, planning for next gen folks or Henry's, right? Like, you have different opportunities there, but it's just, you have that perception. And when you think of, you know, if I said, okay, name two movies that are about finance, like, what comes to mind? I don't know, The Big Short and Wolf of Wall Street, which are like super hyper masculine movies that are not an accurate portrayal of what you know, advisors are doing on a day-to-day basis. And so it's really important to have a better narrative and understanding. And that's why I'm working on that course and really working as an advocate to provide that clarity and show that there is so much opportunity here. And so there are just definitely, if you have the ability to be a mentor or a mentee, you see higher significant retention rates of the mentor and the mentee. So integrating that within a financial planning firm can be immensely helpful. And then, you know, just chatting with next gen folks and looking in different places. So I recently did a workshop with an organization and they said, people are just fishing in the same ponds, expecting to get a different, you know, species of fish coming out, right? So people will say to me like, there are no diverse people here. And I'm like, yeah, there are. You just might have to look at different types of places, right? And start building relationships with different types of universities or going on site or looking at different jobs that in different fields that might be applicable. So like a lot of women or people want to leave healthcare and nurses have taken licensure and exams and they would be a great fit. They're service oriented. They are, you know, patient first. They would be great for financial professionals. If you see a cooling in the real estate market, majority of realtors are women with college degrees who are educated and have taken licensure, so they could come on over. You could look at educators. If people are looking to leave education systems, they could be a great fit to come over. So instead of, you know, just going to one business school and thinking that's the only place that you can get great, talented folks, like you can expand and look beyond that. One comment I will make is that though this industry is not necessarily all math driven and like you don't have to be a so and say like a numbers person, like you do have to fundamentally know level of math. So I've seen like tweets before, like you can be a financial advisor, you don't even have to know math. I'm like, no, like that's not accurate. Like I teach an investments course, like you definitely have to know a level of math. And yes, it's definitely more relationship focused and leaning into empathy and understanding that aspect. But we are experts and we are helping people with complex financial issues. And so there's definitely like a level of math, but it's definitely a level that you could learn and you can excel and be great. And I love this industry so much. And I think there are a lot of talented people who could be great financial professionals within financial services. They just have a couple of cultural and pop culture barriers and maybe a misunderstanding of what it's like to be a financial professional.
And I think you're right there. And I think that those are really good points. And I think that the math idea is that it, the perception is that you have to be basically a math nerd and like a 4.0 math person. And I think that there is an ability to learn the math and there's tools to help you with the math. And it's not to say you can come in and know no math. I agree with that. But it is the key value in this industry is what wins people over is not your skills in math. It's your relationships with them. And it's such a deep bonded relationship when it becomes emotional. There's so much psychological aspects that are involved in it that is such a big key. I'm curious, as we get into this diversity, I have another question on talent, but I want to flip to diversity for a second. And you kind of alluded to it in the last question. I'm curious where the work needs to be. Is there such a big pool of diverse candidates out there, or is there still work that needs to be done there to help educate like what y'all are doing in such a great way on what the options are? Or is like, where does the work lie? And it may be on both sides. It may be on the talent pool side in terms of the people, and it may be also on the business side. But I'm curious of what that work looks like. You know, I love that idea of let's look outside of our industry for talent, right? Nurses and et cetera. Like these people understand how to have relationships. They have to have empathy. They have to have a lot. Like that's a super interesting way to think about it and to bring them in and train them inside of your organization. But I'm curious because there needs to be more women in our industry than there are. There needs to be, you know, more diversified races in our industry. Like it's insane where it is relative to where we are. And so I'm always trying to say, I think we've made some progress. I don't think it's even nearly enough, but where is the most work needed to kind of push this needle further, faster?
Such a complex question, which I don't know if there's one specific answer, but the first thing that comes to my mind is having these larger institutions looking at different areas. When you look at hiring there, like within, let's say a smaller firm or a medium-sized firm, it's like you're asking kind of family and friends and those that are within your sphere of influence. And if we're already a predominantly white male and older demographic, then you're maintaining those different circles of influence that have been there and then perpetuating that moving forward. So just starting there where you're like, okay, let's look at something else. Also, when you're finding, when people are applying to jobs, it's still like 80 to 90% men and then, 10 to 20% women, not including non-binary folks in that statistic. And it could be just the job description. And you also look at women self-selecting out of, applying for a job. So men, if they are 60% qualified for a job, they will apply. Typically, women are waiting till they're at least 100% qualified for a job to apply. So even educating women that, you can still learn and expand. Like if it says that you need to be an expert in e-money, you can learn that on the job. So I think it's also helping that narrative. It's also looking at different types of groups. I remember once I was at a NextGen event and I was having a conversation with a financial professional and I was talking about looking at, looking at different areas. And they said, well, I'm not going to hire someone that like works at my dry cleaner. And I'm like, actually, maybe you could. If they're very service oriented and you have like a great relationship with them and they are very client friendly and perhaps they're currently underemployed or they mentioned like, well, I don't know if anyone like went to a community college if I can't have them like having typos in an email. And just because someone went to a community college doesn't necessarily mean that they don't know how to read or write or spell. It's probably because they didn't have access to funds or they had family responsibilities or perhaps they were being good stewards of the money that they did have, right? Like it's closer to home, it's in-state tuition, and they went into less debt. So I think there is, sometimes an elitism or a perceived notion of like what they think about when they think of financial services. And so it's, I think, the company's responsibility too. I know that there are a couple of really large players in the space that have dedicated billions of dollars towards this effort. I think with the rollback of affirmative action with colleges, it actually has had a consequence within private workforce, which it does, the rollback of that does not apply to private, but you see, DE&I positions getting eliminated or eliminating those departments because they don't want to be too controversial or too woke or things like that. But when you look at, like McKinsey data, that diverse teams perform 19% better, when you're looking at a revenue aspect, like it makes more sense to have more diverse folks within those institutions. I think also universities at large could do better about educating their students around different job opportunities. But I feel as though financial services has been so vague that, someone knows an insurance agent and that's what they picture as a financial professional, which insurance agents are very talented folks, but like what they do on a day-to-day is very different than a trader on Wall Street or someone who might be doing holistic financial planning. And so there's also this education part, which is why I love the work that I do, where I can help bridge the gap between those two. Essentially, when I came into this industry a decade ago, I was like, this whole industry needs a rebrand, right? It's not portraying what it really is in the real world. Additionally, there has been some progress in different groups. However, if you look at even like certified financial professional women, the amount of women who were CFPs 20 years ago is the same percentage as it was 10 years ago, which is the same percentage as it is today. So I think there needs to be concerted efforts within these organizations with the CFP board. They do have scholarships, but it gets a little bit tricky with the rollback of affirmative action. But looking at those CFP registered programs and proactively reaching out. The last comment I'll make is around the job and job applicants applying for it. So inbound job applicants, you might have your like 80-20 breakdown, let's say, 80% men, 20% women. I think firms have to do a little bit more of a proactive reach, right? If you're looking for a specific talent, you have to reach out and you find this person. So same thing with my Next Gen Advisory Task Force. People are like, there's not that many diverse folks within here. And I'm like, literally in a 6-week period, I have, you know, 40 of the most diverse people in financial services put together. Some of them I knew before, some of them I didn't know, but it was a proactive outreach and saying like, I need you. And sometimes this has been difficult in the past where, you know, people reach out and be like, oh, are you just looking at me because I'm a woman or because I'm the most talented? Which I'll ask that in an interview question. I'll say that. I'll be like, are you interviewing me because I'm the most talented or because I'm a woman? Which is like a very challenging question and they can't answer it from an HR aspect and they usually get very uncomfortable and I'm just trying to gauge like their culture level because sometimes it might be one or the other or it might be both. And so it's just having firms proactively reach out to ideal candidates. But if they haven't done the work internally to make their culture inclusive and try to remove unconscious bias and microaggressions, things like that, you're not going to keep them very long. And that's why they say like diversity can be very costly if you haven't made inclusion as part of it. And that folks really want that sense of belonging. So you have like diversity, equity, inclusion, but belonging is where you can feel comfortable showing up as your authentic self every day. But I know of women and diverse people that say like, okay, like I used to not do like really bright nails because I didn't know how clients would react to that. Now I'm at a place and in a culture where I can express myself authentically. However, in the past, I wasn't at one of those locations. And so I think there's so many layers, but institutions need to think about their business models, think about cultures of inclusion. They need to rethink how they're making job descriptions to be more accurate of the representation of what you're going to do as a financial professional, which is help and serve people. They need to proactively reach out to different types of candidates. And then on the candidate side, it's like getting more educated and working with universities to understand what a job in financial services looks like.
It goes back to if you want any real change, there has to be a leader of the change, which is what y'all are trying to do. And there's so many other organizations, but then there's got to be work that's put into it, not just by the leaders, but by the people doing. And so it does fall on us. And I think it does fall on the talent pool also to investigate further what being a financial advisor really is. I think it's a duality. It's a both sides. And it's like what great work that y'all are doing to help with that. I want to ask one more question before we kind of wrap up here. And it's still, we're staying all on the talent side. So we may have to have you back to talk about the training aspect and everything of that nature. There's so much great stuff here. You're just a well of knowledge and insight. And so I'm so appreciative of it. You know, we're talking about next gen as well. And the next gen talent question is always around. I want to take this kind of a separate angle. Is the storyline or the headline that spending life at one firm not happening with this next gen, is this a reality or is it a headline to sell clicks for people?
I would have to do a deeper dive in the research, but anecdotally what I've seen, and I've seen a couple of numbers come through, is that Gen Xers typically have had like 3 to 5 jobs and millennials have already had, you know, somewhere between 7 and 10 different jobs. And so you see that pivoting. And one thing that's challenging within financial services is that jumping firms, you can get the pay increase that you feel like you deserve, need, want, et cetera, quicker than you can do internally. So some firms will have increased limits. So, you know, a promotion, you can only go 10% of like current salary. However, if you've gotten more professional designations or credentials or brought on more clients, like perhaps your comp level needs to change. That's looking at it from firms that might do like a salary comps way. And then I think there's, you know, people evolve and change and they might have different priorities or different values. I have seen it where if I've been at a firm longer than this period of time, am I like not testing myself and my knowledge and my intellectual capacity enough There are still some firms out there where you'll see people that will stay on for a long period of time. And maybe that's an incentive package, or that's like a cultural thing, or maybe it's a fear within that one person's dynamic of their life. However, you're seeing lots of folks change, but that's for comp related reasons where, you know, if a firm is resistant to pay you more, and someone will pay you more and you can do the same. One thing that's important there is if your firm is part of protocol, which means that you can bring your clients with you. So there's different institutions that are part of protocol that are not. And then if you have non-competes or not, but you see a lot of folks making that adjustment so that it can get paid what they feel like they're worth.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, where the question was going, and maybe we can do an answer quickly and then we'll wrap up. But you know, I'm curious of what has changed with regards to companies and their team, their employees, from your perspective, right? Anecdotally, there doesn't need to necessarily be research, just from your perspective, because you're close to this, that has evolved since, you know, historically, right? You know, I think about my parents or like grandparents, like they stayed at a company forever. Can we put the pin on that idea of saying that it's due to going from a DB plan to a DC plan and not having pensions? Like, or are companies doing something differently that we need to take a look at in the mirror as leaders of our companies? Of it may be on us, it may not be them thing. Is it, from your standpoint, do you see something there that, because it's historically people stayed at companies for a while, forever, even, you know, from a comp standpoint and everything, what has changed from your perspective?
Well, aside from the DB to DC argument, you do also have a lot of more transparency because of social media and different websites. So you have things like Glassdoor and payscale.com. And so people have more transparency. Also, I think people participate in more pay transparency amongst peers, right? Like, how much are you getting paid? How much am I getting paid? What's interesting within these financial services companies is that right now there are firms that are paying unreal amounts of money to recruit talent there. Multiples that you probably will never see again for, you know, books of business or things like that. So people are trying to gather assets that way. So if someone's going to pay me a 7x multiple and normally I'm getting like 2.5 and 3, like I can be very incentivized to make a move, which in the past, perhaps like you didn't see that. Also, you've seen this big emergence of private equity within financial services. So you have these private equity firms buying minority shares within these RIAs or different DBAs under broker dealers that are infusing money into that firm, whether it's for M&A or to help one of the, you know, founders free up some of their capital, their personal capital that's within the firm. And so you see this infusion of wealth in different ways than you have in the past. And so, you know, if someone is incentivizing, I think we're all like business oriented. So if I'm going to make a multiple that I might not ever see again, I'm going to make that adjustment. And then I think there's, you know, this movement towards values-based and purposeful work, where if I'm not feeling valued or I don't feel like the work I'm doing is aligned with it, or if I have, you know, let's say I have a special needs person in my life and now I'm really passionate about doing special needs planning and my firm doesn't specialize in that and they have no interest in that, and I could move to another institution that I can live that part of my life more fully. And, you know, you have social media and a ton of people that are like building this narrative of different types of income and different type of income streams. Also, you have firms that are way more strict with compliance than others. And so if I want to network and market through, let's say, a social media platform and my firm doesn't allow it and this firm does, like that might be a natural move. And so I think you have that. And then you add in people just, I feel like in a post-COVID world, like people ask themselves more internalized questions and like, am I just going to sit here for the next 30 years and do the same thing? And the answer is no. And perhaps they're looking for time autonomy, or they're looking for a different work-life integration, or they're looking for path to success and path to leadership. And by moving, I can go faster. So it's very fascinating to see this emergent, but I think the private equity wealth infusion is very fascinating to see the dynamics with how RIAs will look in the next couple of years.
I agree with you there. So insightful, so incredible. Lindsay, I mean, we could talk for hours. I love to hear your perspective and your views. And this has been just really, really, really fun and insightful. Before I let you go, maybe we'll do a rapid fire here with the last two questions. What's one book out there that you think everybody should read if they haven't, or reread if they have?
Yeah, so The Book of Boundaries by Melissa Urban just came out. She's the founder of Whole30, but she has very specific scripts in there around like what you should or shouldn't say. And it is incredible. So if you have any trouble setting boundaries, read The Book of Boundaries. And even if you think you're good at setting boundaries, you should read The Book of Boundaries.
I love that. I haven't heard that one yet. I love that. Last question. We talked about a lot, and there's some things that we didn't even get to that you may want to provide insight to for our listeners. But what's one piece of actionable advice, or the best piece of actionable advice you think that the listeners can take to implement today, tomorrow, to better themselves, the firm, the industry, whatever it may be?
Yeah, I would say take a more forefront role at being an ally, whether you're a man, woman, non-binary person, but that is really just speaking up for people and also being an advocate in a way. So knowing how to validate and express for them and being a sponsor. So sponsor is writing a check and making that difference. So if you can make a step towards becoming a better ally and doing some research on that, I think that is immensely helpful for the industry at large and for you as an individual.
Awesome. Well, like I said, this was an amazing conversation. I'm inspired. I can't wait to continue to follow your journey. I'm sure there's people out there that want to continue to stay in touch, you know, help out in any way, work with you in any way. So what's the best way for people to stay in touch and continue to follow you?
Yep. You can find me on LinkedIn, Lindsay Lewis, CFP, CHFC, MBA. And you can follow me on your social platform of choice at Influencing Finance.
I love it. Lindsay Lewis, this has been incredible. Thank you so much. And I can't wait to talk with you again here soon. So stay well, be well, and talk with you soon.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Bridging the Gap. Don't forget to give us a rating and let us know what you think.